Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Long Story Short, the podcast about storytelling and connection. I'm Jeff.
And I'm Sophia. Through this platform, we highlight the unique stories of people making a difference as marketers, entrepreneurs, and social impact advocates, or people who are all of the above. On this week's show, we chat with Lauren Volpe, a high-growth marketing leader with 15-plus years of experience building high-performance teams and driving revenue through innovative demand generation programs.
She brings a metrics-driven, integrated marketing approach and persona-based messaging to educate, influence, and evangelize customers through the entire buyer's journey. Lauren has guided marketing strategies at global enterprises, mid-stage companies, and tech startups, including Sigma Computing, Pivotal, VMware, and Equinix in the United States and EMEA. While at Pivotal, Lauren led a rebrand initiative, was a key member of the IPO team, and contributed to the company's subsequent acquisition by VMware less than 2 years later.
With that in mind, we had to have her on and discuss product-led growth.
So without further ado, please enjoy our conversation with Lauren Volpe. Hi, Lauren. Thank you for being with us on Long Story Short.
Thank you for having me.
The theme of our episode today is all about product-led growth. And before we get too deep, we like to start by setting the stage. And so from your perspective, I'm curious, how would you define what product-led growth even means?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jeff. I think for product-led growth, the way that I've defined it is that most users today, especially in the digital world, they want to spend, you know, the first part of that research and buying cycle looking and evaluating the product before they're really ready to talk to sales. In fact, I think one Gartner research report found that 80% of the whole buying cycle is really just about education and research and self-service. And folks really don't want to be hassled and really talk to the salesperson until at the very end when they've kind of evaluated and are ready to make a buying decision. And so, you know, B2B marketing, you think, you know, you're marketing to businesses, but you're really marketing to individuals in those businesses. And so the way that we've tried to design that customer experience is pushing the information and content and actual product to those folks so they can evaluate and make decisions for themselves before they're ready to talk to a sales team.
I think one other key piece of what you just said there is the focus on the user, because I think so often in B2B marketing and sales, we think of it as how do we get the buyer right involved, and the buyer in a lot of cases is not the user. And so, you know, to me, I think one of the tenets of product-led growth is really that still all that focus is on the end user. Mm-hmm. And sure, while you will engage the buyer at some point in that discussion, the whole idea is how do you get it in the hands of the user, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think in a couple of companies I've worked at, to your point, often the end user isn't going to be the one that has the budget or the purchasing power, but they're the ones at the end of the day who are going to be using the software. And so you want them to get really excited about it and to have that that hallway conversation with their teams to share, hey, have you tried this cool product out? I think it's really interesting. It's worth a look. So you create sort of an organic pattern in the company where other folks want to give it a try and see what it's all about.
So I'm glad you brought that up. I would love to hear in terms of from your perspective in your career, what experiences have you had in some of those organizations that were really product led?
Sure. Yeah. Going back to where I just spent 10 years at Pivotal, then got it recently acquired by VMware. The developer was the prime user of our software, where they were being able to push applications into production. And during the beginning of COVID, and even before that, a bunch of folks got really excited about Peloton. And I'm sure you guys are all familiar, right? It's like a media company first, exercise bike second. And they really got into the height of popularity during COVID, when folks could no longer go to the gym and work out. And so I was an end user of it when we moved to London in 2018. And what I found really exciting about it was I was like, oh my gosh, like this is the way that everyone should experience virtual conferences or events or classes, right? It should be around personalities and music, and you really know those teachers as human beings, and it doesn't have to be so formal and like an anonymous thing. So you almost build like a relationship with the expert on the other side of the screen. And so because of what was going on with Peloton, we try to drive the Peloton experience, if you will, into our virtual Spring One conference that was really for the developers. So much of event software these days is basically taking, you know, a webinar and then trying to expand it out into a trade show format where you have these awkward virtual booths and people are entering in and you have these like avatars engaging with you. And it just feels really awkward and not really engaging. And so we had this whole project where we were trying to build out a whole developer experience where you really have that face-to-face, like super HD fun, you know, someone's in their living room delivering a hands-on keyboard class, and his partner, his wife, came up behind him and was serving tea, and all of a sudden she became part of that class, and he, you know, was like very casual, but he just introduced her, and people on the other end were all these developers from all over the world were typing in the chat how amazing it was to see Dave's, you know, wife serving him tea. And so that it was just like a really wonderful human moment. But how do you bring those more natural experiences into the learning experience? Because we were all stuck at home during COVID trying to figure out how to navigate, how you still stay relevant in your career and still learn new content, but you're kind of stuck at home trying to figure out like, well, how do I really want to spend that 45, 60 minutes of my day to on-demand content? So we try to build that experience out in this conference so that it just took them a level up. So we did things like we hired on these dancers to do, you know, dance classes in the breaks. And there was an artist, like a, you know, you could just watch him paint at 8 o'clock in the morning. And that we integrated Slack into the actual conferences, because why make people use some out of the, you know, out of the box event chat mm-hmm. tool when everyone already is on Slack? And you saw people's faces and you made it really fun and quirky and just really natural. So that was one experience where we really tried to make the end user number one in that digital experience.
Yeah. The two things I want to highlight there. The first one is, as you called out, sort of like the clunky virtual trade shows. And again, I guess I get it, which is like, you know, once we couldn't do things in person and it was, you know, sort of caught everybody off guard, obviously, it's sort of like, what's the most obvious way to translate something that we would have done in a physical space to virtual? It's like, let's literally create avatars and we'll kind of walk around the trade show floor. But
yeah.
I think to your credit, the idea of like, no, okay, let's take sort of the environment people are going to be in to account. Like, what's the optimal experience knowing that people are at home potentially, you know, working out of their bedrooms, right? So, mm-hmm. And the other key piece that I really love is, because I've always just gotten the sense as an event attendee, is that it's always download our app. You know, everything has its own sort of one-time use thing. And so the idea of integrating the tools that people are already using, mm-hmm. it seems like a small thing, but I imagine, again, I think that's a huge way to drive real engagement and not just, you know, something that feels a little more disposable.
Yeah. I mean, one area that I think we spent a bulk of our time on was the single sign up, right? How people register mm-hmm. and try and put their information in, whether it's a conference or a free trial. But that single sign on experience, I think, is such a barrier to people to attend if you've got to fill out your information multiple times or you have to go through multiple screens. And so I loved what Drift has done, where they've integrated in this kind of chat like function, particularly on mobile, where it feels like you're engaging with a kind of like a little robot on the other end, and mm-hmm. they kind of do this progressive profiling where they're like, hey, Jeff, can I get your email? And then it does like a dot, 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 and you put in your email address. And if they already know your information from previous visits, it just pre-populates that. And they just kind of want to verify something like your mailing address to send you some swag. But I think that part as being in the marketer and on the user and design team and product team, you want to create the most frictionless experience possible so that folks can really, at the end of the day, just get into the system, consume the event or consume the free trial, where they don't get turned off because you've asked them so many questions that they get annoyed and then they leave, they abandon the whole experience.
And it seems obvious when you say it, but I think it's just so, so important to reiterate the, like, putting the user at the center of everything and working backwards from what is it they need. And you said it, that frictionless experience, because I think we've all found those little moments that really set you back. And it's just like, what, you know, you already have this information. Why am I filling the same thing out on three screens? And so it's just anything that puts the user on the forefront, getting them in as quickly as possible. But it's, you know, frankly, it's just not the approach that a lot of companies take.
Yeah. Yeah, slowly because of COVID, I think people had to accelerate and figure that out pretty fast.
Yeah. So from your perspective, I want to dig into how it affects, you know, sort of the way you market and how you've been able to be effective throughout your career. So what are some of the key tactics or nuances that you've seen as being really effective in a product-led environment?
Yeah. I think, you know, there's probably a good amount of time that you could spend inside of a virtual or in-person room brainstorming and trying to figure out what you think is the best experience for your target audience, whether it's an IT person or a business person. But for us, I think the moment that we really started to have a breakthrough content and being curious about what the end user and customer is really doing is going straight to the source. And so a couple of things come to mind. We started using a tool at Sigma called Gong, which I think a bunch of folks may know or are familiar with. But it essentially records and transcribes all of your customer prospect demo and conversations, both visibly, you know, capturing the presentation slides, and then it actually tracks all the different folks on the call. So you could essentially like do like a control find and search for keywords that you were looking for in different customer demos, first, second, third meetings, and try and find kind of the nuggets where customers are giving you the real feedback of, oh, hey, how did you hear about Sigma Computing? Oh, you know, I just typed in an Excel interface for data and I found your website, you know, like nuggets like that. The marketers on our team would have a weekly session where we're all assigned a call that the sales team would basically highlight in Slack and say, hey, you know, we had a really great call with so-and-so company. You should really check this out. And so we'd all take it on as a homework assignment and then have a meeting and discuss, you know, the findings we heard back from the customer, you know, both positive and negative. But what it did is it gave us a whole supply, a database of messaging that we could then take back to the customer and feed them through demand gen, you know, advertisements, display, the website experience, but really the source is the customer themselves telling us, you know, how they came to find us, what they didn't like about it, what was missing, or just kind of where they had that aha moment is really what the marketer is always looking for.
And one thing within that, and it's something that we're seeing more and more now, especially as more of the buyer's journey has shifted digitally. But the idea that ultimately really the secret weapon is understanding your customers and prospects, right? Like I think that's pretty clear in the market today. And there's so much of that. And we get in these conversations all the time. And so I love the fact that you're in on these sales calls, because so many of these things, there are already these touch points that exist, right? It isn't necessarily a matter of doing some big project, and you can do that too, but there are a lot of places where some of these touch points already exist. So it's really tapping into what is already happening, and a tool like Gong, of course, that can then turn this into searchable and can kind of create quantitative analysis from the qualitative conversations as well is super helpful.
Yeah, the other one that we found is we partnered really closely with the UX team at Sigma, and there was two routes to trying to understand what was going on with our customers. We could have done phone calls where we called a bunch of folks and asked them, you know, how they came to find Sigma. But what we ended up doing this last round was we found that 25% of our commercial base found us through organic search, but we didn't know what they were searching for. And so we sent out a survey basically offering them, you know, $100 Amazon gift card. We're kind of like, at what price point will people respond to a survey? And I was like, well, I'm a VP. I don't think I'm going to do anything like under like $50. It may not be worth my time. But if you give me $100, like, sure, there's a chances are that people respond. So we sent out a survey to a good number of those folks, and we had a really, really strong response rate, and basically asked them a series of questions around, what were the words that they were searching for? What do they see on their website? How do they get to the free trial experience? And what do they experience in that free trial that allowed them to then evaluate and become a customer? And so gathering all that information there was also a huge win for us, because we weren't guessing. We weren't really kind of walking in the dark trying to figure out, you know, what are the messages that we should be delivering to our customers, because we were going back to the ones who went from being prospect to customer and asking them, going straight to the source.
One of the first things that stood out to us as we've gotten to know you is how open you are to learning. So we're really interested in learning from you where that originated from.
Yeah. trying to figure out, I think that the thing that I realized from a really early age was, none of us are really experts in life. We're all trying to figure it out and see what success looks like around us. And, I grew up in the North Bay in this suburb, just across the Golden Gate Bridge called Marin. And it's a very, you know, prestigious, suburb full of folks who founded big companies and have done really well in Silicon Valley. And I, was not part of that world, that ecosystem. I was actually, raised by a single dad. I had two brothers and, you know, we were just normal kids who my parents had happened to move us over here for the amazing school district. And so I was really fortunate in the sense that I was surrounded by, a lot of wealth, but a lot of successful, both, male, founders as well as single women who had figured out their careers. And so at a very early age, I figured out how to adapt and kind of watch folks around me and see what they were doing to be successful. And so a couple of people stood out to me. I had a friend who had a single mom who had lost all their properties in San Francisco from the 1989 earthquakes, and they were basically left broke. And she was really scrappy, and she figured out how to open up her own interior design and carpet business, and really quickly just got her clients of folks that she knew. And it started out in her garage, and she ended up having a really large business where she was putting carpet into majority of hotels in San Francisco and people's homes in Marin. And then similarly, a girlfriend, twin girls I grew up with down the street, they were adopted twins from Brazil. They had a single mom, and this was in the 80s. And she was like this badass single woman who decided to adopt twin girls on her own, had an advertising career, and basically like worked her way up in a really male dominated world. And so I just kind of saw these people around me who were navigating really tough situations without anyone really guiding them, but seeing that they were just figuring it out. And they were hustling and they were determined. And it was kind of like almost like this survival mentality, but it was one that had led them to a lot of success and kind of like, if you see it, you believe it. And so I saw these women around me doing really well. And I was like, hey, I could do that. Like, even though my mom wasn't in my life, I knew I was like, I could be a strong female if I put my head, you know, focusing on something I want to do, even though I had no idea what I wanted to do in reality. The point was like, you want to go do something, you find that North Star and you just build your way to get there. And so step by step, I think I've done that with my career, you know, getting myself into college, moving back to the Bay Area. And it was like 2004. So it was the year after we were in a war with Iraq, and there was no jobs. There was literally like zero jobs around. And I was like, okay, what am I going to do? I've got like no money to my name. I'm burdened with school debt from going to school out of state. And I literally, the only thing I could get was an unpaid internship for this technology company in San Francisco. But I had to figure out how to save enough money to rent a place in the city. So I would spend all day, you know, working at this internship, learning the basics, the fundamentals of marketing. And then I would hop on the ferry back to Tiburon, where I would wait tables at a cafe and just like save up and squander all that cash until I had enough to put down for a deposit for a place in the city. And lo and behold, 6 weeks into the internship, I just hustled, figure out how to build a website, stuff some collateral for some trade shows, just like surround myself with other experts who had done really well in their career and just learn from them, just watch them, ask them questions, got to know them. Then slowly but surely, I was hired on as a full-time marketing associate, and just really from there, had a really strong boss and mentor who would redline my work and tell me how terrible it was and all the improvements I needed to do to be decent, because I wasn't even decent in his mind. And so I think I've gotten far with like a little bit of that tough love management style, but also someone at the end of the day who sees your potential. Right? They saw that I was willing to put in the work, that I was open to taking the feedback, that I wasn't too good for anything. I was willing, you know, very early on in my career, I didn't have anything to stand on besides a diploma and some hustle. So I think that's just the way I've navigated my career since, is like, I want to learn and I want to try it. I don't know if I'm gonna be good at it, but the worst I can do is fail. And also failures is not a bad thing, right? You learn through your mistakes.
Yeah, definitely. And then that's influenced how once you the tables turned and you became a leader, you characterize your leadership in a way that I really love of calling it humble leadership, which we actually recently had an episode all about brave leadership. And so having you bring this up not long after, I'm really interested in delving into that a little bit as what does humble leadership mean to you and why is that such an important quality for a leader as well?
Yeah. Recently when I had gone back from being at a really large company, you know, VMware was 30,000 people, and then going back into the startup world, I consciously wanted to do that because I was managing a team of 50 and I had really great managers underneath me, but I craved being on a team again, like playing team sports. And I almost was like felt uncomfortable being treated like an executive. It actually was more of a discomfort for me, to be honest. And hierarchy in general, I think, is something that I personally is not really in my set of values. I really value being equals amongst your team and having a diverse set of individuals all contributing their point of views and sharing ideas in a safe place. So, I really was seeking an environment where you've got people of all different ages and backgrounds being able to work collaboratively together. And I was really, really lucky to have joined Sigma, where at the time I joined the company, it was 15 marketers, and I hired on since another 7. And it was just so interesting for me to get to know these people and their background, like where they came from, who their parents were, what drove them to get to their career in marketing, and what motivates and gets them excited about their job every day, and what kind of ideas they have to bring to the table. I just think it's a gift for me, because at a certain point, like you could feel like you're hitting a point in your career or as you age, like that you start to like plateau and you're no longer learning anything new. And so for me, it was like I was getting to learn more by getting to know these folks and what they have to offer. And selfishly, like it enriches me, right? Because then I'm hearing about new trends, digitally in the marketing world, but also how team members of different generations approach their job every day, because I don't want to be this point where I'm out of touch and I'm no longer knowing what's going on and what's relevant in the world. So, I think we all have something to add to the table I'm a people focused person and manager. And so I get a lot out of building those relationships with a variety of people, depending, they could be older, they could be younger, they could be the same age, but I think everyone has their own story and their background and something to add and bring to the table. And so just being open to that and making people feel comfortable that they can share their ideas. I think in the end, we all get to a better outcome of what we're trying to do. And the number of hours we spend with each other every day working, you want to really get to know those people and understand, them as human beings.
I love the perspective on people-focused leadership. And something we were talking about actually right before we pressed record is that if you just looked at somebody's LinkedIn profile, you can see, sort of the jobs they were at and left and all that kind of stuff. But that's not really the full picture. And I think one of the big parts that's missing is the people and the relationships that follow from company to company. And so I'm curious, personally, how have you seen that impact, your career?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's kind of a misnomer, but Silicon Valley tech B2B is actually a really small world. Like even though thousands of people apply for these jobs and they move here from all over the world, right? People come here from Asia and from Europe or from New York. And my mother-in-law, who's Danish, she actually asked me, she goes, "Can I get a tour of Silicon Valley? I'd like to see what this place is." And I had to laugh because I was like, it's, Venta, it's not an actual location. It's just like a freeway with like a bunch of, campuses on the side. There's nothing really exciting to see here. But in my almost 20 years of working, you actually run in and overlap with folks that you worked with from time to time at different companies, especially if you build good relationships and have great experiences working at those companies. And so even going back to that first job I was telling you about, where I was an unpaid intern and then got paid and started working as a marketing associate, I had worked with a freelance designer by the name of Kun Lam, who was a San Francisco native, and he had always had his own company. And we, that was in 2004, and we started working together. And then from there, we had worked at three other companies after that, to the point where at Pivotal, I was able to convince him to leave his business and then come be an employee there. And he has since, you know, ran all of the design department and is now head of design at HashiCorp and one of my greatest friends and just someone who I just have enjoyed getting to know and traveling around the world with and laughing and, you know, doing an IPO together. But he said something, you know, he's gone through divorce and I've gone through getting married and having kids through, you know, the past, you know, 17 years. But I remember he said something to me a few years ago. He goes, you know, because of our work relationship, like I own a home and I have a family and these things are just like incredible that because of our work relationship, it's allowed us to have these things and feel really secure and stable in our lives. And it was just so funny because, yeah, of course, when we first started working together, we were just like two broke, you know, marketers living in the city, playing rent, trying to get by. And you know, these work experiences are incredible, but it's also the relationships that you build while you're working with those folks that really last long, right? Because we've worked together over multiple companies now, but we, you know, still stay in touch. And actually, it's funny, I'm doing a consulting gig right now for my first boss. So at the first company, him and I, he's in New York now, but we just caught up over the years. And now I'm going to be working with this gang of folks that I haven't worked with since, you know, ages ago. So it's just really important, I think, to stay in touch with people that you have meaningful work relationships with and, you know, to not burn any bridges is really the conclusion. And you obviously work with people that you don't want to work with again, right? Everyone has those experiences that are difficult and challenging. But I would say the positive ones outweigh the ones that weren't so great.
Yeah, I love that. I always think of it, and you and I are right around the same age, and I've had a very similar experience where I sort of go in and out of working with the same people over the course of almost 20 years as well. And I like think of it as like kind of like a snowball rolling downhill, and it's like you kind of gather some stuff, but you figure out what you want to maybe not keep, but you know, you want to keep the stuff that you want. So I love that. And within sort of everybody's, you know, career journey, the most important relationship there is the one you have with yourself. And so, you know, you made a recent shift and wanted to just kind of get your perspective. If you could tell us a little bit about sort of your most recent career move.
Yeah. So as of about 2 weeks ago, I decided to leave my most recent company and just really just take a break from a career that has spanned, you know, 17 years, two kids, two houses, a move to London abroad, a move back during COVID, and just been on this marathon that I think has been at times relentless. And, you know, it's hard to take that pause, but it was a decision that I thought was really important for my own well-being and for my family. And ironically, my husband's a chef and he was out of work for the past couple of years because of COVID. And he just ironically returned going back into work. And so it was just kind of fun to do that role switch where I get to be at home and help out with my 5 and 8 year old kids who are really starting to remember and have, you know, solid kind of imprints of like what the roles their parents played in their lives. And if I were being honest with myself, the past 3 years, I've put work as my number one kind of child in this life that I've been living, spending most of it on the road and you know, putting my team and focusing on my team as being the biggest priority. And so it feels really nice to kind of realign those priorities and make like my kids number one right now and spend some time just kind of reflecting on what the last 17 years has meant in my career and what I really want to do with them and what type of folks I want to work with. And does my value set align with the company's value set that I'm going to go work at? And so it's been, it's just a moment, I think, in time that I think I feel really, really fortunate to be able to take this pause and have a look in the mirror and figure out like, who I am, what I stand for, and how I want to be viewed at as a professional woman in this world of that we live in. So it's just you're catching me at a funny moment because it's just I'm fresh off the heels of working straight for a really long time, but I'm smiling. I know you can't see me on camera, but it's a good moment too.
Let's continue riding that high then, because our next question is one that we ask all of our guests, which is, how do you define success? And that can be personally, professionally, wherever you want to take it.
Gosh, that's a tough question. I should have done homework here. I would say for me, I define success based on the relationships that you have with people in your life, whether they're professional relationships or friendships or your partners in life or with your children, you know, how you've built those and what they're built on, that it feels like a really like a two-way relationship. There's give and take, and you have a relationship where you're really learning and gaining value from those people in your life. And those relationships push you to be like the best version of yourself. And people aren't afraid to give you honest feedback. When you're doing well, they're giving you a high five. When you're being a terrible person that day, they can tell you and you can take it. Or when you really need a nudge, you know, to get out of bed and just like start the day over, those folks know how to tell you that, and you listen to them. So I personally feel really, really rich inside because of the relationships I have in my life, both personally and professionally. I've got an incredible partner who moved abroad with me during my assignment, who came back stateside with me and helped take care of our kids while I was returning to work. And I've got these two crazy, fun, loving kids who are at a really fantastic age right now, where they're just developing their personalities and not afraid to be honest with me whatsoever. It's the most, could sometimes be cruel, but also, you know, that honesty, that naive honesty at that age, I think is really telling and real and something to be not undervalued. And then I would say, just thinking about, you know, my career of having just so many incredible mentors and coaches in my life, just had the fortune of having managers who really saw the potential in me and believed in me. Even though I wasn't showing it at that time, they could see that there was something there that they invested in. And so for me, the success I had was those folks pushing me along and putting me into stretch projects and giving me the chance to basically throw me into the deep end of the pool when I didn't necessarily know how to do a certain project or IPO a company or scale a team or build out a demand gen function. Like, there were so many moments where I didn't really know what I was doing or I hadn't experienced it yet, but they gave me the opportunity to try and figure it out. And so even though there was points where I stumbled and I failed, I learned from my mistakes, and I wasn't fired for making those mistakes, right? And in fact, I was rewarded because I didn't make the same mistake again. And therefore I was doing a job that wasn't necessarily the one that I had been hired for, but then I continued to get pushed along into bigger roles and take on more responsibility because I was open to figuring it out and partnering with experts and pulling people in and asking for help and not being afraid to say if I didn't have an answer, I didn't know what I was doing. And so much I think of success career-wise has been having a just incredible peers and managers who believed in me and helped me along the way.
That's great. There is no failure. You either succeed or you learn. So what resources do you have that you'd like to share with our audience? Any books, blogs, podcasts, anything that you've been particularly drawn to lately?
Yeah, I would say probably the one that's on my short list that I listen to on a daily basis is The Knowledge Project by Shane Parrish. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that one, but he does so many interviews with psychologists and CEOs and just leaders from around the world who all basically share their stories of, essentially, as your point, like learning through failure and or models and frameworks that they've built themselves that have made them successful to date. And so a lot of them are authors and they publish books. But what he does is he breaks it down in an hour-long episode and tries to understand how they approach different problems around decision making or, you know, failures of a company or being a CEO during a really hard time. I'd say that one, by far and away, it's gotten me through many years of commuting on tubes and ferries in the morning. And then a more personal one, I would say I've got my little thing pulled up here. I listened to one. It was a really short one. It was with Bill Gates and Rashida Jones. It was called Ask Big Questions. I think they just had like a very finite timestamp, but it was such a great combination because Rashida is like this quirky actress and writer. And of course you've got Bill Gates, who is the heart of the person who's really funding and trying to figure out how to inoculate everyone through COVID-19. And so they had just the great conversations during COVID where she's at home in LA and he's at his house in Seattle. And they're just trying to figure out like, how do we navigate this world that we live in now through COVID-19? And they were just such a dynamic duo. Really a pleasure to listen to those two. And then a book I'm reading right now, which I think has been really inspiring. It's called Huddle by Brooke Baldwin, who was a CNN anchor. And her whole thing is like, she's really encouraging, women to collectively get together and support each other, whether it's outside of work or in work. But for myself, I'm usually one of the only females at the table, at the executive level or at the board level. And so how do you find that huddle, on your own, so you have a support system and people are rooting you on and you've got folks to talk to and really be there to do things that maybe you thought were impossible before if you're all by yourself.
Those are great. And we will link to each of those in the show notes. And then before we let you go, where can people find and connect with you on social media?
Yeah. So Twitter is just my handle's Lauren Volpe, LinkedIn, Lauren Volpe. And I'm also now a member of this really cool organization that I think everyone's reading about popping up in social media. It's called Chief, and it's a female executive group where it is kind of like a virtual huddle. I'm just pretty impressed by it. Like I really listened to Gwyneth Paltrow talk about Goop a couple weeks ago on a call, and just authors, and there's just a great networking opportunity. So if anyone is a member of Chief, please look me up.
That's great. Well, Lauren, thank you so much for taking the time today. And most importantly, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me. It was great talking to you both.
We had a great conversation with Lauren. I love her perspective on building the product and experience all around the end user of the software. And now it's time for Footnotes with Sophia.
Footnotes is where we expand on portions of the discussion that we wanted to learn more about and share with you. Lauren specifically calls out the power of people she's worked with, but now in a predominantly virtual climate, networking and relationship building is completely different.
Yeah, and the first thing I just want to echo from her experience is for me in every point and stop in my career, the people have always been the most important. And I've been really fortunate to work with a lot of great people as colleagues and bosses and mentors. And thankfully, I've been able to keep in touch with a lot of them over the decades, frankly. And I've tried to see myself to some extent like a snowball continuing to gather things as I'm sort of rolling through. And it's been the highlight for me. And I've said this a lot where I care much more about the people I work with than, frankly, the kind of work I'm doing, the title, the salary, anything like that. To me, the people are by far the most important thing.
So what's interesting is that I was reading a Forbes article that cited a study where nearly 500 current and future business leaders found that 90% of them believed the pandemic had adversely affected their opportunities for networking. And so I'm interested if people are such a huge component to career development, enjoyment, et cetera. I want to delve into that a little bit. So for us at Circon Research, this virtual climate has actually created more opportunity. So I want to spend this time talking about how we can develop authentic connections in a time where we are still fairly remote. So Jeff, as a leader, how have you managed to make meaningful relationships with your employees that'll last far longer than the time you're directly working with them, and for the clients that we work with or other business connections?
Yeah, I want to start. I think it's interesting that so many people say it adversely affected their ability to network. I think it's just changed the environment. I think it's changed the climate, but so everything's different. It's not necessarily harder or easier. It's just different. And so for us, for instance, just the use of virtual platforms like Zoom has enabled us to have, frankly, employees that are not in the same location. None of us are frankly within a very close distance of each other, but it's enabled us to work together from afar. Even this podcast has allowed us to talk to people that are all around the world. And frankly, those are people we wouldn't have been able to talk to otherwise. So again, sure, while starting a podcast is not necessarily everybody's cup of tea, or it's not necessarily the easiest thing, I think the first thing is really just reframing your expectation and understanding. And the truth is, as humans, we still crave real, genuine connection. And I think that's something that's not out of reach anymore. Again, it's just going to have to be done differently than we remember it. And so, but the first thing to me that's super important is the intent that gets brought into it. It's approaching it with really that, just that in mind, where it's not a matter of what can I get out of this? It's a matter of no, like, let me just do what I can to create real connection here. And sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not, and it's okay either way. But if you approach it like a transaction, and that there's something that you're trying to achieve, or, you know, okay, this is only successful if this turns into a new client or something like that, I think you'll find it won't really work well. And in my experience as well, some people that have been colleagues have turned into clients, or vice versa. And so to me, it's really just a matter of how can I help, and what commonalities do we have, and leveraging platforms like these just to reach out, but just to remember that so many of us are sitting in our Zoom boxes wanting to make the same connections. And so again, it's, you know, sort of take that extra step and just make the ask.
Something that I liked also cited in the Forbes article was a quote that said, you don't plant a crop when you're hungry. And so it's, you know, networking doesn't only have to occur also when you are looking for something to get out of it, but it can be just a conversation with employees for the sake of enjoying a conversation with employees. And it can be a conversation with someone interesting, even if you don't have a direct transaction in mind between the two people. But then that also makes it much more natural when you eventually do.
I love that quote. I've always thought of networking personally, I've said this myself, as planting seeds. But planting seeds with no expectation for if and when any of these things will grow and bloom and blossom. And, you know, to that point, right? So it's, and there have been people that have come around literally years later. And so again, just from maintaining real relationships has been one of the most rewarding things throughout my career. And something that I, to be perfectly honest, I did unintentionally for the first, you know, probably 10 or 15 years. There was no real outcome. It was just, I enjoy connecting with people. And so I'm much more intentional about cultivating it, and intentional about reaching out and finding new connections. But ultimately it always comes down to, you know, sort of planting these seeds, just trying to figure out how we can help, what we align on. And again, there's plenty of people that I love hearing differences of opinions too. It's not just a matter of finding people that agree with you, but, couldn't agree more that in this environment, it's different. It's different than it ever was. And a lot of us were trained to do, but to be perfectly honest, I think it's actually easier now than ever. And again, the ability to have friends, clients, employees, mentors spread all around the world and be able to be in touch with a lot more ease, frankly, than it used to be. So from my perspective, I think this is the new climate is actually, it enhanced our ability to do that. So thank you, Sophia. As always, all of the research and references can be found in the show notes.
If you want to reach out to us directly about this story or inquire about sharing your own story, you can get us at lsspodcast@circanresearch.com.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us for a new story next week on Long Story Short.